This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes.
You are the new student. Come closer.
Barack Obama, student or teacher?
A trail through the mountains, if used, becomes a path in a short time. But if unused, becomes blocked by grass in an equally short time.
Quoting philosophy to the Chinese, Barack Obama begins a delicate dialogue of economics, trade, and security.
As quickly as you can, snatch the pebble from my hand. When you take the pebble from my hand, it will be time for you to leave.
Snatching economic advantage from the leaders in Beijing, Grasshopper or President Obama has his work cut out for him on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, Grasshopper. It's Tuesday, July 28th. I'm John Hockenberry. Amy Holmes is with me all week. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So on The Takeaway this hour, it's obvious that driving and texting isn't a bright idea. Amy has that story. What's surprising is exactly how dangerous it can be. We'll tell you about an alarming new study and have a larger conversation about distracted driving. We also go deep on Defense Secretary Robert Gates' road trip, what it says about his relationship with the president and the ignorance of the press. These are the kinds of relationships that can shape history, though. Speaking of history, economic historian Neil Ferguson is with us to talk about that U.S.-China talks dialogue happening today in Washington. Based on what I just said there, Neil, at the top of the hour, do you think Barack Obama is the teacher or the student in this delicate Chinese-American dialogue that began yesterday?
Well, he's going to try and teach them that all is well in the Chinese-American relationship, but I think they'll be teaching him that they don't think so and are very deeply worried about our economic situation and its implications for them.
And are we on our way to conflict or not? Stay with us, Neil. We'll talk about that in more of a conversation on the U.S.-China relationship in just a moment. First, everything you need to know this morning. In the headlines, as we mentioned, Defense Secretary Robert Gates is on the road. He's now in Iraq getting a firsthand look at American troops there. And in Iraq, nearly $7 million is missing after gunmen robbed a Baghdad bank. Eight guards are dead. Amy?
Back here in the States, President Obama is taking his health message to a senior audience this afternoon. He's taking part in a town hall meeting sponsored by the AARP. Members in the live audience and on the phone will put questions to the president.
The president's Supreme Court nominee faces a key vote today. Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to approve Sonia Sotomayor, largely on party lines. Seven under arrest in North Carolina, charged with supporting terror. The Justice Department says the group's leader, a U.S. citizen, recruited fighters for overseas terrorism. Space Shuttle Endeavour astronauts start the trip home later today. The shuttle will undock from the International Space Station this afternoon. Endeavour is now preparing for a Friday landing. Wall Street went up yesterday, but just barely. Today, the Dow starts trading at 9108. The S&P begins at 982. The NASDAQ kicks off at 1967. Later this hour, we're going to learn that where there's a will, there might not be a way. The brain is very good at sorting out what is diet food and what has real calories. Jonah Lehrer is going to talk about that. The brain and dieting. We're looking for your take.
My name is Rick, and I'm calling from Atlanta. My takeaway is food is processed to make the brain want it even more, just like cigarettes and nicotine. So if they stop processing food, then we'll stop getting fatter.
A conspiracy between the brain and food. Actually, Jonah Lehrer is going to talk about that later. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What do you want to use your willpower to stop doing, stop eating, stop thinking about? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, I'm Amy Holmes, in All This Week with John Hockenberry. It's the second day of high-level talks between China and the United States in our nation's capital. Yesterday, Barack Obama welcomed 150 Chinese officials to Washington, D.C.
The relationship between the United States and China will shape the 21st century, which makes it as important as any bilateral relationship in the world. That really must underpin our partnership. That is the responsibility that together we bear.
as important as any bilateral relationship, the president said yesterday. The global economy, trade, and the environment will be among the topics discussed between these two global leaders. Paul Eckert is following the talks closely. He's Reuters Asia correspondent in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us this morning, Paul.
Good morning.
Good morning. Paul, are we going to see anything more this week than just symbolic posturing between these two sometimes partners, sometimes rivals?
Well, in terms of concrete agreements to do this by a certain date, I doubt we will see anything more. But I do think that it will set the tone and there will set a schedule for working group and technical level meetings across the range of the topics being discussed. And that should count as some movement forward, I would think.
Well, yesterday we heard the president publicly stress words like cooperation, dialogue, respect. What are the key objectives of the administration in these talks this week? Will they get down to brass tacks?
Not quite brass tacks negotiations. Several Chinese officials I spoke to after the first session yesterday said that there were very serious and frank discussions, but more exchanges of views. What the United States wants to do is assure China that its own economic house is being put in order. That includes U.S. debt. That includes getting U.S. growth back on track. That includes managing inflation, I'd say. From the Chinese, the Americans want a recognition that they can't just flood the world, and especially the U.S. market, with cheap exports as a model to grow. And those days are over because the cheap and easy credit that Americans have enjoyed over the last decade or so has dried up.
Well, the president mentioned some other sensitive issues in his speech yesterday. Let's take a listen.
We also strongly believe that the religion and culture of all peoples must be respected and protected, and that all people should be free to speak their minds. And that includes ethnic and religious minorities.
So the president got into some of the human rights territory. We know that the Chinese government has cracked down on the Uyghur Muslims minorities recently. Tibet remains an ongoing conflict. Will these discussions this week about trade and economic interests be tied to issues like these human rights?
Not tied. They seem to go on parallel tracks because the State Department is handling the political strategic issues and the Treasury Department is handling the economic issues. I don't see a lot of concrete. I do see only an exchange of rhetoric when it comes to things like human rights and religious freedom. I don't see China there yet in terms of being able to discuss it in a serious manner. They have those ethnic tensions you mentioned. Last year was the Tibetan unrest. This year is the ongoing Uyghur unrest in Xinjiang. Those issues are not something that China can turn around and deliver on in any kind of negotiation timetable.
But what about the big elephant in the room, and that's North Korea and China's potential leverage over North Korea?
Well, that remains a matter of great debate in China and here, just how much China can do to influence North Korea. North Korea is a prickly neighbor, a prickly customer at best. I do think that China is closer to being on the same page with the United States than it ever has been. The trick will be to keep them there because China is not thought to have the stomach for the toughest possible measures that it might take to get North Korea to seriously deal with the nuclear issue. And that's something that will be an ongoing concern. There are a lot of moving parts because North Korea itself has basically survived by maneuvering among the powers that that sponsors it over the years.
Well, certainly we'll be keeping a close eye on these talks this week. Paul, thank you so much for joining us. That was Paul Eckert, Reuters Asia correspondent. Over to you, John.
So the North Koreans are very good at dealing with all these powers there, as Paul points out. But let's bring Neil Ferguson back, Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard University and the William Ziegler Professor at the Harvard Business School. He's also the author of The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. And let's point out right at the top, Neil, that you coined this term chimerica, which suggests, at least in a single word, what Barack Obama seemed to be talking about yesterday, and that was that this is the most important bilateral relationship of the 21st century. Do you agree?
Yes, I do. A few years ago, my friend Moritz Schularik and I were trying to work out what was driving the global economy before the great crash arose, and we decided that chimerica was the answer, the marriage between China and America that had created almost one economy right at the core of the global system. And it's an extraordinarily unbalanced marriage because one partner does all the saving and the other does all the spending, or perhaps I should say did all the spending. China was exporting, America was importing, China was saving, and America was splurging. And I think the key to the crisis is actually that this relationship is now a marriage on the rocks. I thought the president's speech was very interesting indeed because he clearly gets it. He sees that this is the key, and he's also concerned that that Chimera could be falling apart on his watch.
Although the question is, what do you do about that? If it's unbalanced economically, is that to say that the only clout the United States has in this U.S.-China relationship is military clout, strategic clout, projection of power in the Pacific, that sort of thing?
No, I think it has financial power. You know, when you owe the bank a small amount of money, the bank has the power. When you owe the bank a really large amount of money, you have the power.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
And the United States is in the position of being the biggest debtor on the planet, and China is its most important creditor. Remember, the Chinese weren't lending to us out of altruism. What they were doing was intervening to keep their own currency relatively weak against the dollar. That meant that they were essentially selling their currency and buying ours, and accumulating as a result more than $2 trillion worth of international reserves, most of which are held in the form of dollar-denominated securities, and a very big chunk of those are U.S. Federal treasuries.
Well, let's do the numbers there. $2 trillion in debt held by the Chinese. It allows the Chinese to keep their currency low-valued, which favors their exports.
Right.
The issue of, sort of currency exchange, of floating the yuan, is the hottest issue in these talks yet. It seems to me, and you've postulated in the past, that if this current course continues, the U.S. and China are inevitably headed for serious conflict down the road. Would it be better to push the issue of the yuan and the exchange rate now, even though it's so sensitive, to avoid more serious strategic conflict later on?
Well, I think it's important to focus on these financial issues because the strategic questions in many cases are really something that can be postponed. For example, it's clear that China has enormous ambitions to be a naval equal of the United States in Asia Pacific, but it's nowhere near being ready for that yet. The issue of finances is prime time. It's really the key now because the Chinese have been saying since March, indeed even earlier, since the Davos World Economic Forum, that they're very nervous about the way the United States is combating the financial crisis by printing money. They look at the scale of the deficit that we're likely to run this year alone, and they ask themselves, how long can this go on?
Well, let's talk quickly before we go then. Is this setting up like Germany and Britain in at the turn of the 20th century, where it appeared that they were headed for inevitable cooperation, but instead it was World War I? And yeah, in this particular case, you have the potential, and I don't know if you saw the news conference yesterday, Barack Obama standing in that nice background with the two flags together as though they're the same flag, the Chinese and the United States flag, waving together. Are we headed for cooperation or for something much darker?
100 years ago, the United Kingdom was the dominant power and Germany was the rising power, and they were economically deeply intertwined in terms of trade and in terms of investment. And yet, of course, just a few years later, they ended up being at war with one another. Now, I'm not saying we're going to get a war between the United States and China anytime soon, because there's a long way to go before the Chinese are militarily in a position to take on the U.S. But I do think that this intimate relationship that was based on Chinese saving and American splurging is coming unstuck. And over the next 10 or 20 years, I think we'll see the breakup of Chimerica and the emergence of a Chinese-American rivalry, similar to the Anglo-German rivalry that ultimately produced the world wars of the last century. I think that's highly likely to be our future, unfortunately, for Chimerica.
Finally, is there anything out of the fine print, and Amy and Paul talked about this a moment ago, and the posturing of this ceremonial meeting that we could look at as a sign of stability and maybe a sense that maybe this isn't coming unstuck? What do we look for, thinking ahead over the next couple of weeks?
You know, I think there's so many things they can disagree about, but the one thing that I think they are going to agree about is that neither China nor the United States is really serious about doing anything to reduce CO2 emissions and avoid climate to change. That, I think, is the tragic truth about Chimerica.
Looking for some good news there from Neil Ferguson this morning. Lawrence A. Tisch, professor of history at Harvard University. William Ziegler, professor at Harvard Business School, watching the China-America dialogue taking place in Washington. He's also the author of The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. Thanks, Neil.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes, and all week with John Hockenberry. 2 weeks ago, our partners at The New York Times started a conversation with their Driven to Distraction series that examined the dangers of driving while intoxicated with your personal electronic device. You know, that BlackBerry you commonly refer to as a crackberry? Well, a new study finds, and it'll be released today, that predictably enough, driving while texting makes you 23 times more likely to get in an accident. So put down that text messaging, listeners. This morning, we're joined by Dr. Rich Hanowski, director for the Center of Truck and Bus Safety at Virginia Tech Transportation Institute, which conducted the study. Good morning, Rich. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Thank you. Also with us is Adam Bryant, Deputy Business Editor of the New York Times, who's been working on the Driven to Distraction series. Welcome back, Adam.
Good morning.
So first to you, Dr. Hanowski. You've studied transportation for nearly 15 years. Just how bad is text messaging?
Well, I mean, this study that we just completed here clearly shows that there's probably nothing worse than you can do while you're driving behind the wheel is texting.
So how does it compare to, say, driving while drunk?
Well, it's really an unfair comparison. The whole thing with drunk driving, we know from fatal crash data that alcohol is involved in somewhere between 30 to 50% of all fatal crashes. When you're talking about making that comparison, you know, if there was a true comparison with the explosion of cell phones in vehicles, we would also have seen maybe a doubling of fatal crashes over the years. That just hasn't happened. So that's just really an unfair comparison to make.
So what is it about text messaging that makes it so dangerous? I mean, it seems sort of common sense. If your eyes are on your cell phone or your BlackBerry, they're not on the road. Is that what's going on?
That's exactly right. As part of our study, we had video cameras inside vehicles. And I want to point out that this is a real-world study. These were drivers that were working their normal delivery runs in a trucking environment. And what the video showed us was their eye glance maneuvers, where they were looking just before the safety events occurred that included crashes. And that's exactly right. You know, when they were engaged in these devices like texting, their eyes weren't forward. They were on the devices, as you would expect, not paying attention to the road. And this is then what led to their safety event.
So, but lots of things go on in your car. Like, what about when you're jamming out to your favorite tunes on the radio? Or you have
in the rearview mirror. Even.
Right.
Yeah.
Or you have some unruly kids in your back seat and you got to yell at them to cut it out. How does texting compare to that?
Well, with our study, and we had documented and identified probably on the order of about 30 different types of tasks or behaviors that, again, these were truck drivers, so I guess no babies in the back seat. We can't make that comparison. We did have occupants, so that's, I guess, the closest comparison. The difference is, again, is it's all based on this eyes forward. Driving is a very visual task, and if your eyes aren't on the forward roadway, especially in an 18-wheeler, you know, they're not real forgiving in terms of if you make an error, you're going to be off the road very quickly. So if your eyes aren't forward, you know, that's the big problem.
So you also find that the combination of teenage drivers and texting is basically a disaster, and you recommend a total ban on the texting, I mean, not the teenagers. Can you explain this?
Yeah, that's correct. We've done other studies at the Virginia Tech Transportation Institute not just focused on trucking, as my study was, but also with car drivers, light vehicle drivers. And we're just finishing up a study right now focused on teen drivers. And in the preliminary results part of the analyses, but yeah, we're seeing very similar findings with regard to texting, iPod use, other what we call nomadic devices. So these are devices that a driver will use outside their car and bring with them inside their car and attempt to interact with it just like they would outside. And so, yeah, that's those types of devices that, again, are very engaging to people and then to drivers when they're behind the wheel are very problematic.
So I'd like to bring Adam Bryant, Deputy Business Editor of the New York Times, into the discussion. Your newspaper has generated a lot of conversation with this series. You also have a great web game that tests people's ability to focus in situations similar to driving while texting. What's your reader response been like?
It's been phenomenal. We've set up a comments board on each of the stories, and so far the first two generated, I think, more than 500 comments.
Wow.
The following day, Maureen Dowd wrote a column about distracted driving, and she got more than 500. And just the response around the country from other news organizations, it does seem to have started a conversation.
There's no way Maureen Dowd doesn't text while driving, right, Adam?
But she acknowledges that in the lead of her column, that she was talking on the cell phone once and got into a very small accident, but said that she would never do it again and acknowledged that she did. So
what are your readers commenting to you? Are they outraged by people texting while they're driving? I mean, it seems common sense that you just don't do that.
Yeah, a lot of people are sharing stories of all the crazy things that they've seen drivers do, you know, not just texting and talking, but watching TV and applying makeup. And some people's responses were, if I could summarize in one word, duh, you know, that they were saying this is obviously dangerous and obviously something should be done to stop it.
Is that a word in the New York Times style book, duh?
We have a few different variations, but...
But what about some of those readers, I'm sure, who say, look, my car is my office. I get stuck in traffic. Can't I just look down and text a little bit?
Sure, and whether it's stoplight or if you pull over at the side of the road, but I think what happens is there's a creep that goes on. One of the questions we tried to wrestle with in the first story is why do people do this? Why do they feel such a tug to their devices? And Matt Richtel, the reporter, talked to a lot of brain researchers, and the sort of theories that it says we get a buzz from, you know, the red light on our BlackBerry. We have to check it. There must be something going on. We've got to check it right now. A little dopamine squirt, as one of the researchers called it.
Indeed, that's why they get called the crackberry. Adam, thank you for telling us about your report. That was Adam Bryant, the deputy business editor with our partners, the New York Times. And now we turn to Femi Okeh for today's headlines.
Thanks, Amy. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. The U.S. Coast Guard says that around about 85 people are missing after a boat carrying Haitian migrants capsized in the Caribbean. Lieutenant Commander Matthew Morlach from the Coast Guard says that the journey from Haiti to the U.S. is a risky one.
It's a very dangerous journey, and unfortunately, many people lose their lives trying to reach the United States illegally, anywhere of 100 or more per year.
Survivors say the boat hit a reef as it tried to hide from police. In central Baghdad today, a gunman killed 8 people during a bank robbery and then made off with nearly $7 million. Iraqi security officials say bank holdups often fund counterinsurgents. And finally, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates is in southern Iraq for a surprise visit, and we'll have more coming up on that next. That's a look at your news headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. The Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, arrived in southern Iraq this morning. He was in Israel and then Jordan yesterday. His profile as a member of Barack Obama's administration is high, or is it? Let's talk about this relationship and what it means for security both in the Middle East region and in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and just much more broadly in the world with Professor Anthony Cordesman, Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning.
Let's talk, first of all, about Barack Obama's famous promise during the campaign. And this is how our editorial discussion went yesterday as we're trying to figure out what it means to have Robert Gates visit Iraq versus, say, Hillary Clinton or George Mitchell, the envoy, visit Iraq. And some people were saying, look, Barack Obama wants to de-emphasize the Pentagon in projecting American power. And so Gates is a small print visitor from Washington. But others were saying, no, actually, this relationship, because it's a little mysterious, possibly suggests a deeper power in the background. What do you think?
Well, I think both of these positions confuse media exposure with the role of a cabinet official. Gates is an extraordinarily effective and influential official where it counts, which is in setting defense and military policy. Iraq is still at war. We're involved in a very complex problem in moving U.S. troops out while trying to maintain influence over the Iraqi political system and still conduct an ongoing insurgency. This is not the place where the Secretary of State is needed. When Secretary Gates went to Israel, he didn't become involved in the Arab-Israeli peace process, but he talked to Defense Minister Barak and sent a very clear message that the United States did not want military action against Iran at present. And you have a cabinet official who has to deal with defense issues in Korea, in dealing with the Russian nuclear disarmament program, in covering the war in Afghanistan and dealing with Pakistan, and all of this in the defense sector. It doesn't mean that the State Department isn't very active, but the whole idea that you have only one cabinet official being visible in dealing with the kind of global problems we face today is based, I think, largely on sheer ignorance.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the credibility of Robert Gates. I mean, as you say, his credibility comes from the fact that he has this vast experience, and of course, the Pentagon has this vast reach in regions well beyond the Middle East. But on some level, is that an argument because Gates is a Republican and isn't an appointee explicitly of the Obama administration, as a holdover from the Bush administration? Is this an argument that essentially Pentagon policy in the Obama administration is status quo?
Well, no, because quite frankly, again, what you have here, I think, is an almost incredible level of ignorance as to how the Pentagon actually works. What you have is one holdover in the secretary, a deputy secretary who was part of the Obama campaign. Almost all of the policy people, in fact, all of them are new, including all of the people making money and basic resource decisions. They all came out of the Obama administration or out of Democratic think tanks and centers. Power in Washington is not a matter of partisanship, particularly for someone like Gates, who has decades of service which are not partisan in character, and who basically came in to the Bush administration to salvage the mistakes of Donald Rumsfeld, who is an intensely partisan official with nonpartisan conduct. We're talking about $500 billion in terms of money. Two ongoing wars, a major threat in Iran and in North Korea, the problems of disarmament. And to look at this as if it was some kind of petty political game in which cabinet officials play musical chairs is just totally ignorant of how the power structure really works in Washington.
Well, no, I mean, I'm certainly not saying that. And I don't know where the charge of ignorance goes, and I won't take it personally. But I do wonder where the corrective measures from the Rumsfeld era end and the sort of broad strokes of a new vision from the Obama administration begins as far as the Pentagon is concerned, in your view?
Well, I think first, the almost radical shifts in Afghanistan are a very key indication. They're not going to be easy to understand because you're not going to see some dramatic revolution. But there is a completely different approach to organizing the war, to resourcing it, to admitting how serious it is, to dealing with the problems in Pakistan. Now, here Secretary Gates is working with Secretary Clinton. He's working with Richard Holbrooke. You have actually a far more effective team under Obama than you had under Bush, where you had an almost constant disconnect between state and defense. For the first time, you're seeing a real surge in civilians going into Afghanistan. In Iraq, you're watching a process where the administration is having to change some of its campaign work because it's having to deal with a much more complex situation and withdrawing from Iraq than I think it realized in coming to office. But you're also seeing a steady strengthening of the State Department role as the defense role phases down. So again, you're seeing a major shift, which may not be as apparent in the press as it is when you go out there in the field.
Well, the hopeful-sounding Anthony Cordesman, who's been out there in the field, talking about Afghanistan being the place to watch for broad strokes of new policy in the Obama administration, and also the complexities in Iraq. Plenty to take a look at there. Anthony Cordesman is the Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much, Anthony. And now Femi Okeh has our headlines.
Thank you, John. 22 minutes to the top of the hour.
My mother's leaving you alone, right? She's in the control room watching. She's a huge fan of yours.
I have to
explain. She's visiting
today. The Hockenberries are in the house today.
She's a monster fan of yours.
I'm adopting your parents.
If she bothers you, just let me know.
I love your parents.
Thank you, Femi.
Yeah. I was going to say the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree.
Great.
I don't know. Then I'd have to give you a compliment.
Let's move to that.
This just in, Femi says something nice to John. Good morning, everybody. So the talk at the White House today is on the economy as the two-day U.S.-China talks wrap up. The Chinese are the largest foreign holders of U.S. debt, and representatives have raised concerns about the growing U.S. deficit. In North Carolina, seven people are under arrest for charges of supporting terrorism. The Justice Department says that the group's leader, who's a U.S. citizen, trained and fought in Afghanistan before returning to the U.S. and recruiting others. The Texas businessman R. Allen Stanford wants to be moved from a private prison because he's been without air conditioning and shares a cell with up to 10 other inmates. Stanford is jailed on charges of operating a multi-billion-dollar pyramid scheme. Now, Atlanta is on its way to become the first major U.S. city to actually eliminate all of its large public housing projects. They are beginning to be replaced with a mix of higher rent and subsidized apartments and homes, and other major U.S. cities are taking similar steps. That's a look at headlines from today's news. John.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry. President Obama has been pushing health care all week. We've been reporting it all week, and actually last week and the week before. Today, he takes his case for health care reform to senior citizens. In a so-called telephone town hall, the president will take calls from AARP members via phone, email, and a small live audience. The town meeting starts this afternoon at 1:30 Eastern. For more, we go to Drew Nannis, who's a spokesman for the AARP. Drew, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, this sort of electronic town meeting isn't to say that people who are in the AARP can't actually make it to a real town meeting, right?
No, not at all.
No.
In fact, we've been doing them around the country for months now.
There you go.
We've implemented these teletown hall meetings over the last few weeks, and they've met with pretty significant success. We're hitting about 70,000 people are tuning in per hour. So we've been doing them. This is the next in a series. We'll continue to do them.
And what are the very specific questions that seniors have? I mean, it seems to me that of all the constituencies, seniors are both very involved in healthcare for some obvious reasons, but also have an infrastructure that's maybe more robust than some other families in the United States.
Yeah, you know, the questions are really a range, and frankly, I think the questions that are being asked are not just questions that older people are asking. I think it's questions that everybody's asking. Everything from, you know, the very basic, how are you going to lower my drug costs, to, you know, I hear that they're looking for savings in Medicare. Is that going to affect me? Down to debunking a lot of the myths. I mean, as you know, there's a lot of propaganda out there. You know, the internet can be a dangerous tool sometimes. You know, some emails get forwarded, and people want to know, you know, am I going to lose my health care when I'm 75? And we've been spending a lot of time just educating people, letting them know, you know, no, you're not going to lose your health care. No, there's going to be no rationing. Nothing will get between you and your doctor. And the one thing I think that's coming through loud and clear is that people are concerned that, you know, that their initial concern is if they like what they have, including their doctor, they want to keep it. And that's AARP's position. And frankly, it's what we're seeing in a lot of the legislation. So we're very happy about that so far.
Drew, Amy Holmes here. Here's a question just about stagecraft. Are these questions screened, and is President Obama warned in advance?
That's a great question. No, absolutely not. In fact, we're not even warned in advance. We are going to take a mix of questions, and how we're going to do it is we just advised this yesterday on the web somewhere late morning. We already have 20,000 questions that have been submitted.
Wow.
We're not going to answer all of those, unfortunately, but we will get to a lot of them. What we're going to do is we'll take a mix of a few questions that have been submitted in advance, but that no one will see. We'll take a few questions from the audience. That will be theirs to ask, and we'll take some from the phone. And the way it's been
right.
working is the only screening we've been doing is just to make sure the questions aren't re-asked.
Right,
as you might
right.
imagine, you know, something like drug costs are...
So it's repeats that you're
right,
most concerned
exactly.
about. 1:30 Eastern is when this gets started. It's a testimony to the organization of the AARP that I've already been texted twice that senior citizens are not AARP members. Anyone over 50 can be in the AARP. Finally, during the prescription drug debate some years ago, it was believed that the AARP had a financial interest in the outcome. Does the AARP have a financial interest in the outcome of the current health care reform debate? And we just have a few seconds here.
Sure. The only interest AARP has in making sure everybody has access to affordable health care, we've said it before, we'll say it again, nothing would make us happier than for the products that bear our name to no longer be necessary in the market.
All right. Drew Nannis is spokesman for the AARP, which sponsored a town meeting, a teletown meeting with the president, which begins this afternoon at 1:30 Eastern. For more, go to the AARP website or thetakeaway.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes. Coming up, we'll tell you about a conspiracy between your brain and the calories in your food. Yes, willpower gets trumped by the brain. Jonah Lehrer will tell us why in just a moment. But first, headlines with Femi Okeh.
Thank you. Almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is on the road. He's now in Iraq, getting a first-hand look at American troops there. He's meeting with top local leaders and American commanders in Baghdad. Now, he started the visit in southern Iraq. He's also expected to visit Iraq's Kurdish area. Now, that happens just after the region's election. Now, recently, Gates was in Israel. Today, U.S. Special Envoy George Mitchell is there. Both he and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu say that they've made progress in their talks. But there's no sign of a breakthrough yet. The U.S. wants Israel to stop construction on lands that Palestinians are claiming. Israel has so far declined to do so. The president's Supreme Court nominee faces a key vote today. The Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to approve Sonia Sotomayor largely on party lines. That clears the way for a full Senate vote. She's expected to win confirmation with a handful of Republican votes. A new study shows that American volunteering is up. The Corporation for National and Community Service says that volunteer workers spiked by a million in 2008. The top activity was fundraising. Collecting and distributing food came in second, and nearly 62 million Americans volunteered last year. And finally, Space Shuttle Endeavour astronauts start the trip home later today. The shuttle will undock from the International Space Station this afternoon. Endeavour is now preparing for a Friday landing. And do you know, Amy and John, that in the last couple of days, the most people in space gathered under one roof at ever.
13
people.
That we know of. I mean, yeah. You know, there may be aliens up there.
This is possible.
That's right, exactly.
Yes.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Now, an update on a story we've been following all morning. Currently, a dramatic rescue operation going on in the Caribbean. More than 100 Haitian migrants have been rescued after their boat capsized off the Turks and Caicos Islands. The United States Coast Guard, which is helping the local authorities with the rescue, is on the scene. With the latest, on the phone now is Matt Morlag for the U.S. Coast Guard. Lieutenant Commander Matt Morlag is his spokesman for the Guard in Miami. Lieutenant, first of all, thanks for joining us. What's the latest?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on your program. We have 113 survivors confirmed right now. We've just upped the number of confirmed deceased to 4. The Turks and Caicos police have been searching for survivors. They rescued the majority of those yesterday. The U.S. Coast Guard is assisting them in their search efforts, and we are searching right now to try and find more survivors.
What is believed to be the cause here? Is this weather? Is this an overcrowded boat, maybe a less than seaworthy craft that had maybe too many people on it?
We're not sure right now. Our focus is trying to find survivors. We'll look towards to find more information about possibly the cause and why this happened at another time. But right now, we're just going to focus on trying to find survivors, getting people who need medical attention to the hospital, and that's going to be our focus.
Got it. Any evidence, Lieutenant, that this is part of maybe a larger wave of other craft who may be in similar peril who are on their way to Miami or points north and west?
Well, we do see illegal migration from Haiti on a frequent basis. We see tragedy involving illegal migration from Haiti all too often. These vessels are generally overcrowded. They can easily capsize if there's any sudden movements. A lot of times they don't have life-saving equipment such as life jackets, and they don't have enough food and water in case they do get stranded to keep them alive for long periods of time.
All right, Lieutenant Commander, we really appreciate that update. Lieutenant Commander Matt Morlag is a spokesman for the U.S. Coast Guard in Miami, where the Guard has assisted in the rescue of 113 people in the tragic capsizing of more than 100 Haitian migrants, boat capsizing off the Turk and Caicos Islands. Excuse me, just wanted to get those details straight. Amy?
I'm Amy Holmes, and I'm in All Week with John Hockenberry. We're talking science as we do every Tuesday, and today we're talking about the brain and food. So here's a simple question we put to New Yorkers. What's the one food you just can't resist eating?
I can't resist Hershey bars.
Chinese food.
Potato chips.
Sushi.
Pizza.
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 Pizza? I don't know. There's a bunch of foods I can't resist.
Ravioli.
Andouille sausages. How's that?
Cheese.
Meat.
Fajitas.
Lobster.
Bacon.
A handful of new studies suggest that, lobster, bacon, that in matters of weight loss and resisting food, willpower may not be enough. The brain, which is an organ designed to seek out calories, you know, soak them up and put them in your thighs, could outsmart the tricks that we play on it when we're trying to consume less by drinking diet soft drinks, for instance. Joining us to talk about the brains behind our bulk is Jonah Lehrer. He's the Takeaways science contributor and author of How We Decide and Proust Was a Neuroscientist.
Hey, hello. Jonah.
Hey, how are you?
So what happens in the brain when we eat food? I mean, how does the brain know the difference between taste and, say, actual calories?
Well, this is a new discovery made by Duke scientists. They took a mouse that lacked a sweet taste receptor, so the mouse couldn't actually taste sugar, and they put this mouse in its little cage with a little dish of water that had been sweetened with lots and lots of sugar. Now, as expected, when you first put the mouse in this cage with the sugar water, it showed no preference for the sugar water because it couldn't taste the sugar. However, what the scientists found was that after just a couple hours, the mouse started lapping up the sugar water even though it couldn't taste sugar. And what they eventually found was that there's a second pathway inside the brain. It's You know, it collects information from your gut, and even though the mouse couldn't taste the sugar water, it preferred the sugar water because there was energy in it. So they've since discovered that there's a separate pathway which doesn't respond to the taste of food, it just responds to the amount of calories in food. Well, so there's something inherently pleasurable about consuming calories.
So scientifically, does that mean the pathway that is focused on the calories is maybe older than the pathway that's associated exclusively with taste?
The scientists aren't sure if it's older, but it does seem to be very important. I mean, this is a very crucial biological function, making sure we've got enough energy, you know, to go about our day. And so this seems to be the job of this pathway. It doesn't care about what the calories taste like. It doesn't care if you're eating a Big Mac or a Power Bar. It just wants the energy.
So doesn't this mean then if we eat diet food that is lower in calories that we can eat as much as we want because your body can still want more, but you're not consuming the calories?
Well, I think this does explain why, you know, if you want to eat one of those, you know, Nutra snack diet Madewell bars or whatever they're called, that you don't stop after just one. You keep on eating until you reach a certain level of calories, and that's simply because the second pathway, it doesn't care that it's diet food. It just wants those same number of calories. I think this also helps explain why a number of studies have found, both in rodents and people, that consuming diet sodas can actually increase the amount of calories we get over the course of the full day. That seems to be because it's very hard to trick the system. So even though you can trick your tongue with, you know, NutraSweet or Equal or Splenda or whatever it is, it's very hard to trick the second pathway, which keeps a very close count and makes sure you're getting enough calories.
So I'd like to bring Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent, into this conversation. Todd, you've also studied neuroscience. You know a little bit about this.
A little. I never studied obesity. I did study brains, though.
But so why is it so hard for us to short-circuit our brains? Why doesn't our brain tell us, you've had enough calories, stop eating?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that, Amy, except that one thing that we always learn from brain science is that these behaviors and the physiology that underpins them has a very strong evolutionary purpose.
Yeah, you know, but what about Charles Grassley's brain, the senator from Iowa who's trying to figure out health care reform? What does it relate to that?
Ah, yes. Thank you for bringing it back to my current area of expertise, John. I appreciate that. Well, you know, this does raise a really important issue. Health reform, hey, we just found out this week $147 billion per year in direct medical costs from obesity. That's just the diabetes, the heart disease, the hip replacements, not to mention the lost productivity. So one idea out there has been to try to cut obesity, certainly by cutting intake. And one way that Congress would maybe cut intake is by taxing sugar, taxing fat and trans fats and those things that make us fat. Surprisingly, there has not been, maybe not surprisingly, there hasn't been a lot of interest shown in actually implementing such a tax that would hopefully discourage people from buying and consuming sugary sodas and fatty foods. But I will say that the head of the CDC at a conference just here in Washington yesterday came out pretty uncharacteristically and said that if Congress were to pass a 3-cent tax on bottles of soda, that it would have an impact on obesity. So take that for what it's worth.
But Todd, I got to tell you, I imagine that a Twinkie tax for adult-paying taxpayers would go over like a tofu burger. Why don't we start earlier in life? We know that childhood obesity is a huge problem, epidemic. It leads to all sorts of problems.
Right, but the tax can have an effect there too, Amy. You know, we have proof that the higher the price in cigarettes goes, the fewer kids smoke. There's no reason why it wouldn't be the same for Twinkies. To the extent that kids buy snack foods themselves, and they do at school, the higher the price, if it's the same as cigarettes, the less they consume.
So thank you very much for coming on the phone with us, Todd. And I guess dieting just got a little bit harder, John.
Yeah, and apparently, according to Jonah Lehrer's science there, the brain is involved if there's an incentive to reduce calorie consumption, but it's very, very difficult. Jonah Lehrer and Todd Zwillick, two neuroscientists, one more preeminent than the other. So we're looking for your take, 877-8-MY-TAKE. What do you want willpower to achieve in changing your behavior? I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Amy Holmes.
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You're doing fine? Well, that's a matter of opinion, perhaps. Cliff Hagedon, owner of the Fort Gratiot Express, driving an 18-wheel freight liner this morning in Meridian, Mississippi. What are you seeing, economically speaking, out your windows there on the arteries of commerce?
I see things starting to happen again.
You mean more people are selling, more people are buying, more trucks are moving?
Definitely.
You know, Cliff, do you want to call it on this national radio program called The Takeaway that, you know, the recession just might be over?
I believe that we have gone through the roughest of times. Whether it's completely over, I can't call that, but it is getting better.
Well, calling it as we see it, whatever we're driving, it's an 18-wheel takeaway. Good morning. I'm pulling into town on the
interstate. I got a steel train. All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
From high in the cab of our 18-wheeler, it's Tuesday, July 28th. I'm John Huckenberry. Amy Holmes is in the co-pilot seat all week. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, John.
Don't touch the transmission there. It can take us right off the road. Good morning. On The Takeaway this hour, the surprising health effects of divorce. Amy's going to have that story a little bit later. Plus, we'll talk to President Obama's point man on trade for an inside look at today's U.S.-China talks. And, of course, more ground-level economic insight from our long-haul trucker friend, Cliff Hagedon. First, everything you need to know this morning in the headlines. President Obama is taking his health message to a senior audience this afternoon. He's taking part in a town hall meeting sponsored by the AARP. Members in the live audience and on the phone will put questions to the president. President Obama's Supreme Court nominee faces a key vote today. The Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to approve Sonia Sotomayor largely on party lines. Amy?
The president's defense secretary, Robert Gates, is now in Iraq getting a firsthand look at American troops there. He's meeting with top local leaders and American commanders in Baghdad. He started the visit in southern Iraq. Staying in Iraq, nearly $7 million is missing after gunmen robbed a Baghdad bank. Eight guards are dead. Police suspect insurgents knocked over the bank to fund their operations.
There are seven under arrest in North Carolina charged with supporting terror. The Justice Department says the group's leader recruited fighters for overseas terrorist acts. Dozens are missing after a boat capsized in the Caribbean. The boat carried as many as 200 Haitian migrants. Former Atlanta Falcons quarterback Michael Vick could return to the NFL under strict conditions. He's been approved to play in practice games so far. He hasn't been signed by a team. Space Shuttle Endeavour astronauts start the trip home later today. The shuttle will undock from the International Space Station this afternoon. Endeavour is now preparing for a Friday landing, and Wall Street went up yesterday, but it's probably going to open down in about a half hour from now. The Dow starts trading at 9108. The S&P begins at 982. The NASDAQ kicks off at 1967. Cliff the trucker says maybe the recession is coming to an end from the view of his Freightliner. We're going to talk more with Cliff in just a moment, but it's your turn. Are you seeing a light at the end of the recessionary tunnel? What are your signs? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give us the picture through your windshield. Send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Amy Holmes, joining me all week here on The Takeaway. And we're looking at economic indicators with human voices behind them. Maybe there are numbers there, but there are also people to talk to, like Cliff Hagedon, owner of the Fort Gratiot Express. And consists of a 1997 Freightliner, a.k.a. Freight Shaker, which is now on Interstate 20 between Meridian, Mississippi, and Texarkana. Cliff, thanks for being with us here at the top of the hour. I don't want to make you late for any sort of delivery. Am I doing that?
No, not at all. Good morning to you, John.
But, you know, are you nervous at all? Because really, you've called the recession possibly being over, and there aren't a lot of economists who have the guts to do that.
That's probably why I'm not an economist. But what I found out here, we have to use load boards to find freight to whether I want to go to New York or I want to go to Florida, I want to go to Texas.
And a load board is basically an offer to, I've got some stuff, needs to go from here to here, and you can track that stuff either online or through your networks and basically figure out how to get your truck from point A to point B.
Exactly. You've hit the nail right on the head. And right now I'm looking in Meridian, Mississippi, and there are, within a 150-mile radius, there are 47 loads and 73 trucks that need to be loaded.
Wow. And a year ago, what would you have been seeing?
A year ago, I would have been seeing 50 loads and 250 trucks.
Wow. So that's a significant change. Would you say that what you're looking at is a leading indicator in the sense that the economic activity that you're seeing may eventually translate into more jobs, more economic activity to people who say are unemployed this morning?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. I don't believe that we're completely out of the recession, but we are making a huge turn.
And talk about what sectors seem to be affected more. What kinds of goods are you moving, and what sorts of goods maybe haven't really been affected by this positive change that you've been talking about?
That's a good question. I know for a fact that the food commodities are really soaring right now, possibly because more people are eating at home. They instead of going out to restaurants or... I don't want to put any singular blame on anybody, but they're just eating more at home, which means we're doing a lot more traveling in that sector. The one that isn't starting to take off real fast is the what we call the flatbed division.
So that would be like the flat screen TVs, electronics, that kind of stuff.
I would say, John, I would say more in the housing. In the building, in the industry, that hasn't started to kickstart yet.
So when you start hauling plywood, start hauling 2x4s, that sort of thing, that's really when you're looking at the tail end of this upturn.
I believe so, yes.
All right, Cliff. Well, you know, we talked to a lot of economists on the program, but I have to say you're sort of down to hard facts here, and we love that here on the program.
Well, thank you.
I'd love to hear that white engine growl right now, but I imagine you don't have a microphone that you could put down to the actual engine itself, right?
Well, I'm sitting at the TA truck stop, and I could turn it on, but you'd hear the air buzzer going off.
Yeah, all right. Well, we won't worry about that. We'll talk to you again soon. Cliff Hagedon, owner of the Fort Gratiot Express, a 1997 Freightliner, a.k.a. Freight Shaker, between Meridian and Texarkana. Thanks, Cliff.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I'm going into town on the interstate. I got a steel train in the rain. And the wind bites my cheek through the wing. And it's these late nights. And this freeway flying always makes me sing.
The Federal Reserve has been putting the pedal to the metal. We have the interest rate as low as it can go. We are putting everything we can into strengthening credit markets. We are buying up mortgage securities to bring mortgage rates down to get people into houses. So we're doing everything we can to support the economy. And we hope that that's going to, you know, get us going next year sometime.
That was Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke yesterday at a town hall meeting where he was at least trying to reassure the audience that he's trying to do everything he can over there at the Fed. Our friend Dan Gross, columnist for Newsweek and Slate.com, joins us this morning. Dan, in this week's Newsweek, you declare that the Great Recession is over. That's a pretty radical statement for those uninitiated, to your point of view. Can you fill us in? How are things looking up?
I just got back doing a turn hauling a 11-year-old to camp in my Jeep, and the highway seemed quite crowded with similar people, so maybe that's a sign, too.
With literally happy campers?
Exactly. Newsweek's cover story says the recession is over, and then there's an asterisk saying sort of good luck surviving the recovery. I had sort of got onto this. Some of the economic forecasters I trust the most, a group called Macroeconomic Advisors, Economic Cycles Research Institute, Alan Blinder, former Fed guy in the Wall Street Journal on Friday, they're sort of crunching the numbers and saying, you know, what this – the way things are aligning, it looks as if we will have positive growth in this quarter. There are all sorts of factors that go into that. The fact that economic activity was so low in the first half of the year that we're getting incremental improvement. The fact that imports are plummeting, that adds to GDP. And the fact that, you know, some activity is picking up, whether it's housing, manufacturing hours worked, leading indicators. All those are pointing to the fact that GDP is likely to be a positive number in the third quarter. Of course, you can't eat GDP growth and you can't use it to pay your mortgage. So there's a degree to which this is sort of a semantic and technical question among economists. But I think, you know, when the time comes to date the end of the recession, it's likely that it will be sometime, you know, in this summer that the economists declare that's when the economy began to expand again.
Dan, you also write, though, that it's not time to pop the champagne yet, that we may be growing, but it feels like we're standing still. Can you explain that?
Sure. You know, remember, in 2001, the economy began to expand in November 01, but we continued to lose jobs through the middle of 2003. That's not how it has historically worked in recessions. You know, factories close down, they sell off the inventory, then they call people back to work. We have this phenomenon now where there's always structural change going on. So right through that recovery in 2002 and 2003, manufacturing continued to go to China, services were outsourced to India. People continued to lose jobs, even though the economy was showing overall positive growth. We called that the jobless recovery. People are now saying we're looking at the mother of all jobless recoveries. The unemployment rate's at 9.5%. Economists believe that it's going to go up to 10% and linger there throughout 2010. We have a lot of excess capacity in this country. U6, which measures people who are working part-time but would like to be working full-time and people who've stopped looking for jobs, is now at 16%, which is a record high. Only 68% of America's factories are in use right now. There's structural changes going on top of the cyclical, you know, downturn that we had. So there's reason to think that we may not have a huge bounce back in jobs anytime soon.
Warren Buffett, he's warned that unemployment could go as high as 11%. So how is the average person listening to our broadcast going to see that the economy is looking up?
I think you're going to start to look for kind of small incremental improvements. One of the differences between this time and previous recessions is that we used to have these big sort of dumb weapons we deployed against slow growth. The Federal Reserve would cut interest rates. The government could cut taxes. We could incentivize Wall Street to go finance everybody who could use money to buy things. All that's out the window now because the interest rates are at zero. They can't go any lower. We're not going to be cutting taxes for broadly across the board anytime soon. We have huge deficits. And Wall Street is basically, you know, incapable now of providing the kind of funding. So the question is, where do we get this growth from? It's not going to be from this kind of top-down mega forces that touched every industry, that let people kind of get money very easily and spend in 02 and 03 and 04. It's going to have to be more from the bottom up. And our article looks at the way in which the Obama administration is focusing on particular sectors, infrastructure, alternative energy, healthcare, broadband, as channeling resources there with the idea that it could create some jobs in the short term, but that by building this new infrastructure, we will create new industries and make America more competitive in the long term. The problem is that the numbers, as far as job creation, are relatively small. You know, you'll find a highway project here with 10 new jobs. You'll find a wind farm over here with 400 or 500 new jobs. It doesn't begin to make up for what we've lost.
Dan, so, you know, people have been debating, did the stimulus work? What do you say?
It is working. You know, it was passed in February. Things are different now. In 1933, FDR could say, get me a quarter million kids out working in the Civilian Conservation Corps. I'll pay them a dollar a day, put them to work. He was able to do that in 3 months. Things move slower now. The White House says only 10% of the employment impact of the stimulus will be seen in 2009. It's sort of backloaded. So it's working, but it's filtering in slowly.
Dan Gross is a columnist for Newsweek and Slate.com. Dan, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So once the divorce papers are signed and you've put on your boots made for walking, so to speak, the divorce is behind you, right? Well, not quite. A new study indicates that getting divorced has such a profound effect, it can adversely affect your health later in life. We're talking about significantly increased risk for illnesses like heart disease, diabetes, cancer, depression. You thought a divorce was bad enough? Linda Wade is co-author of a new study. She's a professor of sociology and director of the Center on Aging at the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. We have her here this morning. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
So your report finds that divorce doesn't end at divorce, can actually make you ill?
Well, yes. It appears that the horrible time that you go through when you're in the midst of the divorce, which everyone knows is emotionally, financially, socially, physically, incredibly stressful, can change the chances that you develop a disease then and carry it through your life.
Well, that's interesting. Let's tease that out. Is it the emotional impact of divorce, literally your heart is breaking, your body is breaking, or is it the economic impact that maybe you're not getting as much health care?
Well, we don't really know what it is. What we know from this study is that it is. So this is really a broad picture looking over many people's lives at the effect of what they did earlier on their health now, specifically at divorce and widowhood and remarriage and how those are associated with their well-being now. And they are, which is a big surprise.
So I'm kind of a mush here, though, Linda. Can I just ask a very personal question? I mean, I'm previously married, previously divorced, but now happily married with a whole raft of kids. Is that good for me? I mean, I was very happy to get out of that first marriage, let me tell you.
Absolutely. The people who are in the worst health are the people who got divorced and stayed divorced. What we're saying here is that that getting divorced increases the risks of some major health problems many years later compared to people who never got divorced. But what our figures really suggest is, for example, on the big diseases, chronic conditions, that compared to people who got married once and stayed married, people who got divorced and remarried, about 1 in 6 of them will develop one of those chronic diseases. So 5 out of the 6 don't show any health effects at all by this measure. So it just increases the chances. It's not a life sentence.
Interesting. So a spouse who's a pain in the neck could become even more of a pain in the neck after you divorce them?
I guess, except I didn't look at pains in the neck.
That's the takeaway. Thank
raise
you.
Raise your blood pressure. Continue to raise your blood pressure.
Thank you, Linda, for joining us. That was Linda Waite, professor in sociology and director of the Center on Aging at the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago.
Thanks, Amy. And if you've followed the news over the last week, you're going to want to listen to this, definitely. Listen to this.
I don't know what's happening. I just had an older woman standing here, and she had noticed two gentlemen trying to get in a house at that number, 17 Ware Street. And they kind of had to barge in, and they broke the screen door, and they finally got in.
Now, that's the neighbor of Professor Skip Gates, Lucia Whalen. Much has been made throughout the story of the Gates arrest in his own home by a policeman in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And there is a actual bit of the conversation that motivated the police officer to go to the Gates house and begin what actually started a considerable controversy and a discussion in the United States really over the last week and a half. Darius Charney joins us. He's an attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Darius, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I have a very quick question. It seems to me that listening to that 911 call, it doesn't seem as though there's anything life-threatening going on. It also seems to be at odds with what we learned about what was going on the porch of Professor Gates' home. But my constitutional question to you is, what is it that says a police officer, under any circumstances, is going to have a pleasant conversation with a homeowner on that person's porch, demanding in the middle of the night their ID and for them to prove that they actually own their home?
Yeah, I don't know if that would ever be a pleasant conversation. Well, you know, the what we're talking about here is really the Fourth Amendment and what rights people have to, you know, privacy, to not have their liberty interfered with by the police. And, you know, in most cases, vast majority of cases, for the police to be able to enter your home without your consent, they would need a search warrant.
This is a 911 call.
Okay,
I mean, there's no time for a search warrant.
Yeah.
Does responding to any 911 call constitute, at least as the courts have ruled, reasonable search and seizure?
No, not every 911 call. I mean, one of the things you hear immediately from the 911 call we just heard was that the actual source of the information of the person who witnessed, I guess, the possible break-in into the home, or what was being characterized as a break-in, was not even the person that made the call. And we actually don't even know the name of the person who was, I guess it's the older woman who actually witnessed the events. So, you know, you essentially have an anonymous source of information. So that's one problem that doesn't, you know, calls into question whether the police really had any basis for entering Professor Gates' home.
Let alone what Professor Gates knew about this 911 call, which, of
course,
was zero. All right, we don't have a whole lot of time here. What happens when it goes from the policeman shows up to disorderly conduct? What does the Constitution say about disorderly conduct in your own home?
Well,
I can be as big a jerk as I want in my own home, can I? As long as I don't hurt anyone.
You're definitely hitting the nail on the head. I mean, disorderly conduct usually means some kind of disturbing of the peace of the, you know, members of the public. You're impinging on other people's peace. And if you're in your own home, I don't know how that could ever be possible. I guess if you were extremely loud and disruptive, maybe that would disturb your neighbors. But you're absolutely right that that doesn't seem to rise to the level of disorderly conduct.
And, of course, other attorneys could disagree on this subject. You are an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, Darius Charney.
Yeah.
Finally,
yeah.
The president is apparently going to meet with Professor Gates and Sergeant James Crowley, the arresting officer from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and have a beer at the White House on Thursday. Constitutionally speaking, is a beer with the president acceptable redress for a constitutional violation of the Fourth Amendment?
Well, I guess if you like beer, yeah, definitely. I'd sit down with him and have a beer, but I'd want to ask him other stuff. So,
does it set a precedent, though?
Yeah, it would set a precedent, and then I think everybody who felt aggrieved by, you know, the government might be asking for a drink with the president,
which could end up being a lot of beer there. One more thought about the Professor Gates, Barack Obama, and Cambridge police controversy. Darius Charney is attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for joining us. And coming up on the program, the U.S. Trade Representative weighs in on the two-day talks between China and the United States now taking place in Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, all. Femi Oke is here to give you the latest headlines.
Thank you very much. Almost 28 minutes to the top of the hour. The U.S. Coast Guard and Turks and Caicos Police will concentrate today on trying to find more survivors from the 85 people still missing after a boat carrying Haitian migrants capsized in the Caribbean. Lieutenant Commander Matthew Morlag says that boats carrying migrants are often unsafe.
They don't have enough life-saving gear
or signaling gear to ensure that they are able to survive if they do have any problems at sea.
So far, four bodies have been recovered. Survivors say the boat hit a reef as it tried to hide out from police. In Washington, the president will take a break from the U.S.-China talks at the White House today to pitch his health care plan to seniors. He's holding a town hall sponsored by the AARP, and members can call in with their questions. This is the sound of change in Atlanta. That is actually the sound of the Bowen Housing Project in southwestern Atlanta being torn down yesterday. Atlanta is on its way to becoming the first major U.S. city to eliminate all of its large public housing projects. The housing projects are being replaced with a mix of higher rent and subsidized apartments and homes. And other major U.S. cities are taking very similar steps. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is expected to cut more programs from the state budget plan today. Officials say that the state needs a bigger cushion in case of emergencies like wildfires or earthquakes. And in international news, Iran's supreme leader has ordered the closing of the prison that was used to lock up many of the protesters detained after the country's disputed election results. Rights workers claim some of the demonstrators have died in captivity. That's a look at big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. It is day two, as Femi pointed out there, of the U.S. and China dialogue. The meetings taking place in Washington, D.C. are all about trade, they're all about security, and they're all about the debt that the Chinese hold in the U.S. economy. Here's President Obama talking yesterday about the American-Chinese relationship.
As Americans save more and Chinese are able to spend more, we can put growth on a more sustainable foundation, because just as China has benefited from substantial investment and profitable exports, China can also be an enormous market for American goods.
Well, there's currently a significant American trade deficit with China. Is there balance between the United States and China, economically speaking? One of the key Obama administration officials at the meeting in D.C. is Ron Kirk, the president's U.S. trade representative. He joins us now. Representative Kirk, thanks for being a part of The Takeaway.
Thank you, John, for having me.
Ron Kirk, is this relationship balanced or is it fundamentally imbalanced at this point in time?
Well, it's one we can improve on. I can leave it up to your judgment to determine whether it's balanced or fundamentally imbalanced. Let me say this. It is not fundamentally imbalanced in that there is so much room and so much extraordinary potential as China develops a true broad-based consumer-driven economy, that the opportunities there for Americans exporters, particularly in the goods and services sector, is what holds such promise for us. So it's a relationship that holds great promise for both sides of the business equation, Chinese and Americans.
Economists around the world say that the only significant lever in China that would improve the status and the ability of the United States to sell inside China, to improve our export sales in China, is a flexible yuan. And it appears as though the Obama administration is going to sidestep that issue in these talks. Wouldn't it be better to focus on that issue rather than have much more serious conflict later on out?
Well, we have folks. I mean, part of the rationale behind President Obama and President Hu agreeing at the summit in which they previously met in London was to establish strategic and economic dialogue chaired by Secretaries Geithner and Secretary Clinton so that we could have more candid, high-level discussions. And in his presentations yesterday, Secretary Geithner, Chairman Bernanke with the Federal Reserve Board, a number of us in the economic sector talked about a broad range of issues. And I know that Secretary Geithner has discussed the currency valuation issue as well. But on the U.S. side, I would say to you, one of the things that we can do to help strengthen not only U.S. exporters, but every business in America is to pass the president's health care reform. If we can take 25% to 30%, you know, much less the 50% goal I think the administration has. If we can reduce our health care costs, that would be an extraordinary boost to all American manufacturers and
right.
exports.
Although I think economists would also say that setting a timetable for a flexible Chinese currency would also have extraordinary benefits to U.S. businesses. And we're not doing that.
Either would be good, but that's a call that President Obama and Secretary Geithner will make.
Which is more important at these talks, the $200 billion of debt that the Treasury wants to sell in terms of Treasury notes that mostly the Chinese are going to be taking on, or is it the $200 billion trade deficit that falls maybe more on your desk?
Well, the most important part of this, these talks, frankly, John, is relationship building. China is a country with over, with almost 1.3 billion people, still 800 million or so locked out of the world's sort of economic system. And as China develops into a more broad-based economy, there's no question they're going to be an extraordinary world economic power, but also potentially the greatest market for America's goods,
right,
services, exports. And so that relationship is going to evolve over time.
But
China's only been a member of the WTO for 8 years. So we are really in the beginning of this relationship.
Well, I wonder about that. I mean, Nixon went to China a generation ago. When does the relation building stop and serious economic change begin? Because to a lot of people, it looks as though the Chinese are buying for time, and that only favors them.
Well, Nixon began to open that door. It was almost 30 years later until China made the decision and accepted the invitation to join the World Trade Organization. That was a huge step in the progression, and not just China's relationship with the U.S., but all of the rest of the world, and particularly China committing to participate in a rules-based global trading
system. I don't think we have 30 more years, though. I don't know if we have 30 more years.
Well, John, one of the refreshing things about this relationship is the wonderful American perspective in which we're trying to squeeze time down to a nanosecond, and the reality that we have a partner sitting across the table that measures time in dynasties. And, I can appreciate your sense of anxiety. We all have that. But the reality is China has an extraordinary amount of work to do to move from essentially a state-based run and managed economy to a free market economy. And there are going to be bumps along the road. But the important part of not only this dialogue, as well as the joint commerce and trade dialogue that Secretary Gary Locke and I will chair in China later this fall, is to have a forum to begin to work through some of those relationships. And they're not all going to be solved in one meeting or two. It takes time.
Well, we appreciate the candor. U.S. Trade Representative Ron Kirk, thanks for joining us, talking about the U.S.-China talks now going on in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Amy Holmes. We're following up in a story we covered back in February, a horrific tale of hundreds of children and teenagers sentenced to juvenile detention centers in Pennsylvania because local judges were participating in a multi-million dollar scheme where they received kickback money for sending teens to privately run youth detention centers. Hard to imagine. Now, thousands of youths who had to appear before this corrupt county judge are in danger of losing the ability to sue for damages and court fees. One of the children caught up in this case is 17-year-old Hillary Transu. Her mother, Laureen, joined us in February and joins us again this morning to talk about the latest in their case. Thank you for joining us, Laureen.
Thank you, Amy, for the opportunity to be able to speak about this case.
Thank you. We appreciate it. So, refresh our memory. What happened to your daughter, Hillary?
Basically, Hillary was accused of creating a parody MySpace page of her vice principal. And the case went to court only because I was informed by the officer involved that if I cooperated and did not get a lawyer, things would go easier. So we went to court. The hearing lasted less than 60 seconds, and custody was removed from my husband and I, and Hillary was placed in juvenile detention.
That's just a jaw-dropping story. She was sent to juvenile detention for a parody MySpace? So,
yeah, well, she was adjudicated delinquent. She was actually put in a camp, kind of pending to see how she would behave. What I think what people don't realize is when a child is adjudicated delinquent, custody is removed from their parents, And even though there was usually a hearing scheduled in 3 months, that taking away custody, that adjudication could last up until, I think, a few months past their 18th birthday.
Goodness. But,
so we could have been talking about 3 years.
But Hillary's home now. You decided to sue the state. What is the current status of that lawsuit?
I'm not sure exactly. You know, Hillary and I are just regular folks, and we are involved with Juvenile Law Center, and they are actually handling that. They're lifesavers. I don't know what these children would have done without Juvenile Law Center.
It's unbelievable. I understand that there are 6,100 other affected families right now that might not have a chance to go the legal route. What do you say about that? What does this mean to you?
I think Hillary's case might be slightly different because she's one of those named in the case. But for those children, there's no way to make up for this. You know, I've heard the saying, you can't unring a bell, and that is so true. But to be able to take legal action and to follow through the proper channels. So here are kids and families saying, okay, we still respect the legal system. We're still going to go through the appropriate steps to fight this. And basically it's being squashed by that same legal system.
Well, I'm sure that these families appreciate that you're fighting for your daughter and for them caught up in this terrible, just really jaw-dropping case. Thank you so much, Lorene, for joining us this morning on such a sensitive and difficult topic. We appreciate it.
Thank you again, Amy, for the opportunity to speak out about this corruption and injustice.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. Coming up, witches, vampires, and viruses. The future of media. We'll explain right after headlines from Femi Oke.
I thought you were going to call me a witch then. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. That would be too easy,
redundant.
Wouldn't it?
Redundant.
Yeah. My middle name.
Okay.
Good morning, everybody.
We love each other.
We do, secretly. Just don't tell anybody. Good morning. So a key housing report is out showing home prices up in major cities. The Case-Shiller Home Price Index says that prices rose 0.5% from April to May. That's the first gain since summer 2006. Prices are still way below last year. They're still at lows not seen since the middle of 2003. Also expecting another economic report. That's out next hour. Forecasters are expecting to see consumer confidence rise a little bit. The man charged with killing the Kansas abortion doctor, George Tiller, has a preliminary court hearing this morning. Prosecutors say that Scott Roeder killed him at Tiller's church. Roeder faces murder charges, possibly life in prison. A new study shows that American volunteering is up. The Corporation for National and Community Service says that volunteer workers spiked by a million in 2008. The top activity was fundraising. Collecting and distributing food came in second, and nearly 62 million Americans volunteered last year. Now, we're getting some reports to say that Thursday...
Are you volunteering? Are you getting paid?
I feel I do that Monday to Friday. It's my community service.
One of the 63 million.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I do like to. It's good karma.
Yes, it is.
I hope it kind of
comes
back on me.
Absolutely.
There you go. Finally, Thursday, beer night at the White House. That's when President Obama, Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates, and Cambridge Police Sergeant James Crowley will talk over a beer. Now, it's not clear what beer the White House will serve.
Yalta beer.
Yeah, well, Crowley was drinking Blue Moon when the president called him. Gates reportedly liked Beck's and Red Stripe, and it's also possible that Boston area brews Harpen or Sam Adams could also get the call. I'll investigate.
That sounds like a lot of disorderly conduct there. Thank you very much, Femi.
You're very welcome.
So if you've seen a billboard, big picture on a big billboard. Okay, that has impact in the advertising world. Not hard to see why, but isn't it great to sort of stumble on something, to discover it all on your own, to find that, wow, what's happening here? Am I the only one that knows about this? It seems almost impossible to imagine, but 10 years ago this week, people discovered this.
I just want to apologize to Mike's mom and Josh's mom and my mom. I am so, so sorry, because it is my fault, because it was my project. I am so scared.
10 years ago, people discovered the Blair Witch Project. Was it a documentary? Was it an ad campaign? Was it a movie? Well, it made millions, and people's discovery of it really spawned the idea of viral campaigns to create a sensation for things that might normally have been just sort of introduced in television commercials that sound like this.
I don't want them living in my neighborhood.
They're just so unnatural.
Should we just let them go and do whatever they want? Absolutely not.
They make me scared.
Say no to the Vampire Rights Amendment.
How did you vote on the Vampire Rights Amendment? Oh, you don't know what I'm talking about? Well, if you are a fan of the HBO series True Blood, you may have stumbled on True Blood through one of these ads. They were created by a Campfire group, the Campfire Ad Agency. Managing partner of that agency is here in the studio with me, Steve Wax. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Also here is Brian Morrissey, a digital editor for Adweek magazine. Both of you in the studio. Amy, I kind of feel like I'm in an episode of Mad Men here, you know? You guys, let's talk about viral ads and viral campaigns, and you know, with all the talk about twittering out of Iran and that sort of thing, social networking has been a real opportunity for ad agencies, but there are successes and failures. Both are interesting. Explain what True Blood was all about and how you began by marketing a drink that was blood and resulting in a series on HBO that really became a hit.
Actually, it was an artificial blood, and the idea was that since there was this artificial blood that arrived from Japan, vampires could come out now. They no longer needed to feed on you and me. So basically, we sent blood out. I actually brought some for you. We sent
Thanks.
Blood out in little tubes to well-known bloggers who then, without any kind of identification, they began talking about it.
Now, Blair Witch, of course, 10 years ago, and some of the people that you work with are actually involved with that, was a kind of an accidental discovery that people love something that feels underground and a discovery all their own. You attempted to marshal this in the True Blood campaign. What's going on when you attempt to set a group of bloggers, some would say just weirdos, to work to spread the word of mouth of something like a television series?
Well, basically, actually going back to Blair Witch, it started with 100 fans. And over a year, my partners built that into millions and by creating a culture that was bigger than the movie. So we try and do that with ad campaigns, so or our marketing campaign. So with True Blood, we created this idea that vampires live among us, and we asked ourselves, what would happen if vampires lived among us?
And, of course, it's not really just silliness, Brian Morrissey, a digital editor for Adweek magazine. I mean, advertising agencies are shifting increasingly into this space where they're trying to set in motion a kind of sustainable chain of 100 fans become a million fans. It's almost as though the narrative, the script of the movie extends to the fans themselves. They're in the movie by being a part of the campaign.
Yeah, that's exactly what advertisers are looking for. I mean, word of mouth has always been the most powerful way people find information. And with viral marketing, basically what advertisers are trying to do is infect social networks and then have that replicate for them. And so this is the best of both worlds for them, because they think, well, if a friend passes it to you, you're more likely to, you know, actually take action on it and to view it. And that's the real opportunity that they're trying to get to. I mean, I think the big problem is for every success, there's probably 25 failures.
Right. Well, people at conferences all over the world talk about the future of everything is social media and, you know, viral campaigns and twittering, et cetera. Is this hyperbole or is it really going in this direction, Steve?
There's a revolution going on. And we were talking earlier, it's a little bit like a virus where we're told we're in the middle of an epidemic, but we don't notice it because it takes place over a couple of years. But people are being fired from ad agencies because they can't do this stuff. The agencies are trying to rapidly change. There's a lot of money changing hands.
Is this different than faux news? This is from a Burger King campaign called Whopper Virgins. Take a listen to this here.
What happens
if you take remote Chiang Mai villagers who've never seen a burger, who don't even have a word for burger, and ask them to compare Whopper versus Big Mac in the world's purest taste test. The Whopper is America's favorite. But what will these people choose? The Whopper virgins will decide.
So, Brian Morrissey, what is the difference between just snarky faux news programming or faux documentary programming and something that really develops this culture, this dynamic culture that Steve was talking about?
Well, I think it's like a blurry line because at the end of the day, advertisers are going to have to, you know, push the envelope with like Whopper virgins in order to get people to talk about that, what they want to talk about. And so they're going to end up having to be controversial to some degree. And sometimes you know, there's this it goes into like stealth marketing, and there's a possibility that instead of playing with consumers that they're going to end up fooling them.
And does that make them mad?
Yeah, actually, one of the things that's electric is the blurry line. So the more you can sort of edge into ethical questions, the more people are going to debate and talk about it.
You love that.
So Steve, yeah. I have a question, and I have to confess, I'm a huge fan of True Blood. I think it's a great series.
It has a great following among women, just so you know. That's the biggest audience.
So, but the question still remains. A viral campaign, it still needs to make an emotional connection. True, so at the end of the day, the product still needs to be appealing.
And you got 20 seconds, Stevie.
No, that's not true. actually, you need to just capture people's attention, and if you can strategically put a brand at the center of the story, that's great. That's the most important thing.
Well, he loves the blurry line, extending the narrative out way beyond the script, involving actual fans and the storyline. That's what it's all about. Steve Wax, managing partner at Campfire Ad Agency, responsible for the True Blood campaign for the HBO hit series, and Brian Morrissey, digital editor for Adweek magazine. Thanks, guys. Are you going to drink all that artificial blood there?
As long as
True
it's artificial.
Yeah, okay.
And this morning, we're looking for signs that point to the end of the recession. We heard from Cliff the trucker earlier this hour, who saw some light at the end of the shipping tunnel. Are you seeing an end? What are your signs? Take a listen.
Hi, this is Francine from Brooklyn, and my positive economic indicator is that I have a job interview today at 3 o'clock. I was laid off in February, and my severance pay went up in May, so I'm really excited. And I have a friend who got employed recently with the city of New York, and I have another friend who has a job interview at a large bank. So things are looking up.
All right, so we got to get her on the program tomorrow morning, right? Absolutely. Gerard in South Carolina emails us, I'm traveling on I-20 near Florence, South Carolina. I've been seeing a lot of large RVs moving north and south. Looks like the snowbirds are migrating and spending money on leisure travel. Tell us your signs at our website, thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything in the show, we're always on. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway from the top of the 18-wheeler.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.